the 2,200-mile journey from trailheads in Missouri or Iowa might take 3 or 4 months, with a lot of luck. History recalls them as the 49ers, because the first big year of the gold rush was 1849. They called themselves Argonauts, after the mythical Greek heroes who sailed in the Argo with Jason to search for the Golden Fleece. Most of them found nothing but disappointment, and many found death. With few women to add a touch of civilization and balance, and no government, it was a pretty rough place. In just one July week in 1850, in a town called Sonora, 2 Massachusetts men had their throats slit. A Chilean was shot to death in a gunfight, and a Frenchman stabbed a Mexican to death. The town of Marysville had 17 murders in 1 week, and at the height of the gold rush, San Francisco averaged 2 murders a day. A miner making $8 a day, about $240 in 2018 dollars, was doing 8 times better than his coal mining counterpart in the East. But prices were outrageous, too. A loaf of bread that cost 4 cents in New York cost 75 cents in the gold fields. All in all, most gold seekers weren't any better off than laborers in the rest of the country. But there was gold, and plenty of it. During the Civil War alone, California produced more than $170 million worth of bullion, which helped prop up wartime Union currency. Remember, the gold rush had other impacts as well. Although many of the 49ers came and left after a relatively short stay, many of them stuck around. From a non-Native American population of about 18,000 in January 1848, California grew to a resident population of 165,000 within 3 years. San Francisco became a booming U.S. port and doorway to the Pacific. The growth and importance of the state also helped spur long-delayed congressional approval of the proposal for a transcontinental railroad. Eventually, California became a magnet for different kinds of gold rushes. Movies, computers, the aerospace industry, and biotechnology all had California roots. But before all that could happen, it had to become a state. Compromising on the slavery issue. Zachary Taylor was probably the least political of all American presidents. He served 40 years in the U.S. Army, but never held any other office before being elected president. In fact, he had never even voted in a presidential election. But the popularity of Old Rough and Ready carried him to the White House in the 1848 election after Polk lived up to his promise not to seek a second term. Taylor had expressed no opinions during the campaign about the hottest issue of the time, slavery, and had no plans for what to do about all that land he had just helped take from Mexico. At the time, the country was equally, if uneasily, divided into 15 free and 15 slave states. So when California asked to be admitted as a state, the debate raged on which side it should fall. Its own constitution banned slavery, mostly on the practical grounds that gold miners didn't want to compete with slaves digging for their masters. Those aging giants of Congress, Henry Clay of Kentucky and Daniel Webster of Massachusetts, urged yet another compromise approach, which eventually became the Compromise of 1850. But Taylor was adamant that California be admitted without delay as a free state. Southerners, led by their own aging giant, John C. Calhoun of South Carolina, were just as adamantly opposed. Representatives from 9 Southern states met in Nashville in June 1850 to consider leaving the Union if California was made a free state. Fortunately for everyone but himself, Taylor helped solve the impasse by suddenly dying. His vice president and successor, a pliable fellow from New York named Millard Fillmore, was more agreeable to compromise. pushed by the last great speeches by Clay and Webster, and with the help of a U.S. Senate newcomer from Illinois named Stephen Douglas, a deal was reached. Remember, the Compromise of 1850 consisted of a series of five bills. California was admitted as a free state. New Mexico and Utah were admitted as territories, with the slavery question to be settled later. Texas received $10 million for land it gave the new territory of New Mexico. The slave trade was abolished in Washington, D.C., and a fugitive slave law was approved that made it much easier for slave owners to recapture escaped slaves by getting federal help. The fugitive slave law put all African Americans at risk because all a slave owner had to do was sign a paper saying the person was an escaped slave, show it to a federal magistrate, and slap the chains on. Although only a few hundred African Americans were victims of the law, it outraged many Northerners, and anti-slavery resentment grew. But talk of dissolving the Union died down. For the last time, a compromise worked. Clay, Calhoun, and Webster would all be dead before it fell apart. Coming over and spreading out. By the middle of the 19th century, there were a lot more Americans than there were when the century started. The country's population in 1860 was 31.4 million, four times more than it had been in 1810. Of the world's predominantly white nations, only France, Russia, and Austria had larger populations. Many of the new Americans were born elsewhere. The number of immigrants to America in 1830 was about 25,000. In 1855, the number was closer to 450,000. They came from as close as Mexico and Canada, and as far away as China and Japan. When they got here, they tended to stay with their fellow expatriates, where the language, food, and culture were more familiar, creating many nations. They also increasingly stayed in cities, even if they had come from a farm background. In 1840, there were 10 Americans living on farms to every one who lived in a town. By 1850, that ratio was 5 to 1, and many of the new city dwellers were from foreign shores. The Germans, the Irish, and the Know-Nothings who opposed them. The parts of the cities they dwelled in were generally dark, smelly, filthy, and violent. Many of the immigrants were so appalled that reality didn't match their glittering visions of America that they went back home. Because of the glut of people wanting any kind of a job when they got here, wages in the largest city were pitifully low. In 1851, New York editor Horace Greeley estimated it took a minimum of $10.30 a week to support a family of five, and that didn't include money for medical needs or recreation. The average factory worker, laboring 6 days a week for 10 or 11 hours a day, might make $5 a week, which meant everyone in the family had to do something to make ends meet. Because they were newcomers, and because most native-born Americans still lived in smaller towns or on farms, there was little appetite for cleaning up the cities. That wouldn't come until the number of immigrants got even larger, and middle-class Americans became affected by it. And still they came, from 600,000 immigrants in the 1830s to 1.7 million in the 1840s to 2.6 million in the 1850s. More than 70% of the immigrants between 1840 and 1860 were from just two areas in Europe, Ireland and the German states. For the Irish, it was come or starve. A fungus all but wiped out Ireland's potato crop in 1845, and there was a widespread famine. So more than 1.5 million Irish scraped up the $10 or $12 one-way fare and piled into America-bound ships for an often hellish two-week trip in a cargo hold. Many of the ships had brought southern cotton to Britain, and in a way, they were bringing back the North's cash crop, cheap labor to work in factories and build railroads. Many of the Irish settled in New York City or Boston. Politically savvy, they served first as soldiers for the big city political machines and then as bosses. Even so, they were harshly discriminated against in many places, and NINA signs hung in many employers' windows. It stood for No Irish Need Apply. Almost as many Germans as Irish came during this period, although they were more likely to spread out. The Germans also came because of food shortages or other tough economic conditions. But many decided to come after efforts failed to throw off despotic rule in the various German states in the late 1840s. Generally better off financially and better educated than other immigrant groups, they brought the idea of kindergarten or children's garden with them. Many Germans pushed away from the eastern cities to the Midwest, especially Wisconsin. The rise in immigration also increased anti-immigrant feeling, especially in areas where the newcomers were competing with people born in America for jobs. In 1849, an organization surfaced called the Nativists. They were better known as the Know Nothing Party because members supposedly replied, "I know nothing," when asked by outsiders what was going on at their meetings. The Know Nothings demanded an end to immigration, a prohibition on non-natives voting or holding office, and restrictions on Roman Catholics. The Know Nothings made a lot of noise for a while. Renamed the American Party, they attracted more than 1 million members by 1855 and managed to elect several governors and scores of congressmen. Their 1856 presidential candidate, Millard Fillmore, who was a Whig, had been vice president under Taylor and served as president from 1850 to 1853 after Taylor died in office, even managed to carry one state, Maryland. But the Know-Nothings faded away as the Civil War approached, torn apart by differences between the party's northern and southern members over the slavery issue. Making Waves, the Mormons. Although one of the Know-Nothings' chief targets had been Roman Catholics, Americans in the mid-19th century were generally a pretty tolerant bunch when it came to religion. About three-fourths of them were regular churchgoers, and there were so many denominations that no one church dominated. By 1860, almost every state had repealed laws against Jews or Catholics holding public office, and the question, "What can you do?" was more prevalent than, "How do you worship?" Of course, try telling that to a Mormon in 1846. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints began in 1830 with the publication of the Book of Mormon by a New York man named Joseph Smith. To escape persecutions, Smith moved his headquarters to Ohio, and then Missouri, and then Nauvoo, Illinois, on the banks of the Mississippi. Nauvoo became one of the most thriving cities in the state. But the Mormons' habits of working hard, sticking to themselves, and having more than one wife at a time seemed to irk outsiders, and the persecutions began again. This time Smith and his brother were killed by a mob, and Mormon leaders decided they needed some distance between themselves and the rest of America. Led by a capable, if dictatorial, lieutenant of Smith's, Brigham Young, the Mormons moved west, many of them pushing two-wheeled carts for hundreds of miles. Finally, they settled in the Great Salt Lake Basin, a forbidding region in Utah that most people thought of as uninhabitable. Establishing a rigidly run society and economic system, the Mormons thrived. By 1848, there were 5,000 living in the area, many of them Europeans who had been converted by Mormon missionaries. Many of the Mormons fought in the Mexican War as a way of earning what had been Mexican territory. In 1850, Utah became a territory. but its statehood was delayed for almost 50 years, in part because of the Mormons' refusal until then to drop their practice of multiple wives or polygamy. Wagons Ho. It's often attributed to Horace Greeley, but it was actually Indiana journalist John B. Soule who advised in 1850, "Go west, young man, go west." He was a little late. Even before the gold rush, Americans in large numbers were heading that direction. Despite the awesome dangers and hardships, settlers piled their belongings into fortified farm wagons and started out, mostly from St. Joseph or Independence in Missouri. Some of them stopped in the Great Plains of Kansas and Nebraska, while others pushed on to the West Coast. By 1846, 5,000 Americans had settled in the Willamette Valley in the Oregon Territory, and by 1859, the territory had become a state. America's manifest destiny was being achieved. Give her a chance. I have heard much about the sexes being equal. I can carry as much as any man and can eat as much, too, if I can get it. I am as strong as any man I know. I can't read, but I can hear. I have heard the Bible and have learned that Eve caused man to sin. Well, if woman upset the world, do give her a chance to set it right side up again. Sojourner Truth, a freed slave who became one of America's most outstanding orators at a women's rights conference, 1851. Becoming aware of women's rights, or the lack thereof. As more and more women got involved in the fight over slavery, many of them came to resent how, in many ways, they were also second-class Americans. Like slaves, women couldn't vote, couldn't retain their property when they got married, and could legally be beaten by their husbands. Leaders such as Lucretia Mott, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Susan B. Anthony began to publicly demand more rights. In 1848, feminists met at Seneca Falls, New York, at a women's rights convention. Stanton read a declaration of sentiments that paraphrased the declaration Thomas Jefferson had written 72 years before. All men and women are created equal. Although some states began allowing women to keep their own property after marriage, and some colleges began admitting women in the 1840s, the feminist crusade was overshadowed by the fight over slavery. For many of their rights, women would have to wait. The beginning of the end. The issue of slavery not only overshadowed the women's movement, it overshadowed virtually every part of American life. The Methodist and Baptist churches split into North-South factions because of it. Families with branches in the North and South stopped speaking to each other. It even strained business relations in a country where hardly anything got in the way of making a dollar. And it was showing no signs of going away by itself. Despite a federal ban on importing slaves, the slave population grew from 3.2 million in 1850 to almost 4 million in 1860, almost all of it through childbirths. Adult slaves who could put in a full day's work had become so expensive that some Southerners began calling for ending the ban on new slaves from Africa. Factoring a slave's life. Remember, actually, about 75% of Southern families didn't even own any slaves, although in many cases, it was because they couldn't afford them rather than because they opposed slavery. But even non-slave owners defended slavery. Slaves, they said, received the benefits of being exposed to the Christian religion, of having cradle-to-grave shelter and food, and of being a contributing part of Southern society. That was more, they said, than many Northern factory workers could say. Of course, that ignored the fact that even the most miserable factory worker could still make his own choices as to where he worked, didn't have to submit to beatings from his employer, and wasn't likely to see his wife and children taken from him and sold off to some other state. Pro-slavery forces also pointed out that slaves were actually well-treated if they behaved. Negroes are too high-priced in proportion to the price of cotton, explained a slave owner in 1849, and it behooves those who own them to make them last as long as possible. And, slavery's defenders said, what would the nation do with them if all the slaves were freed? That was a question that stumped many Northerners who opposed slavery, but did not agree with abolitionists' demand for an immediate end to it. In 1854, Abraham Lincoln, who was then in private practice as a lawyer, admitted, "If all earthly power were given me, I should not know what to do as to the existing situation." But Lincoln and others balked at the idea of slavery being allowed to spread, and that's what the fighting was about. Battling in Kansas. The South wanted a railroad. Kansas and Nebraska wanted to be states, and the combination of wants caused even more troubles. Spurred by the California Gold Rush and Western expansion, Congress was getting ready to decide on a route for a transcontinental railroad. The route that made the most sense, and the route the South wanted, started in New Orleans and moved across Texas before ending up in San Diego. It was the shortest route and went most of the way through already organized states or territories. But Senator Stephen A. Douglas of Illinois was pressing hard for a central route, starting in Chicago. Douglas owned a lot of real estate in the area and stood to make a sizable chunk of cash if the trains ran through his property. Trouble was, his route went through land that had been given to the Native Americans. See Chapter 12 for more details on the railroads. So, Douglas pushed a bill through Congress that organized the area into the Kansas and Nebraska territories. To win Southern support, his bill also repealed the Missouri Compromise of 1820, which prevented slavery in the new territories. Instead, it said people in Kansas and Nebraska should decide for themselves, a process he called popular sovereignty. Douglas argued that allowing the region's inhabitants to decide the issue was the purest form of democracy. But to many, the idea smacked of just passing the buck. And rather than calm things down, it stirred things up. The North seethed with anger. Douglas was burned in effigy all around the North and ripped in the press. Pro-slavery interests in the South were disappointed Douglas wasn't stronger in support of slavery spread. As a practical matter, Nebraska proved to be too far north for crops that would attract much pro-slavery interest. But what became known as Bleeding Kansas became a warm-up for the Civil War. Pro- and anti-slavery factions poured into the area, destroying any notion that the question could be decided locally. Both sides resorted to bloody acts of terrorism and guerrilla warfare. The Little Lady and the Big Book. Harriet Beecher Stowe was a diminutive Connecticut woman who dabbled in writing from time to time to bring in a little extra money. But when the Fugitive Slave Law was passed, it ticked her off enough to write a novel about slavery. She called it Uncle Tom's Cabin. The book was published in Boston in 1852, and it was a sensation. It sold 10,000 copies in 1 week, 300,000 copies in its first year, and more than 1.5 million copies worldwide. Its chief effect was to put human, if painfully stereotypical, faces on an issue that many Northerners had thought about only in political terms. It outraged Southerners, who felt it was grossly unfair. Stowe was hailed as a saint. She was also mailed the ear of a disobedient slave. Stung by accusations that her book exaggerated the plight of slaves, Stowe wrote a second book called A Key to Uncle Tom's Cabin, in which she documented all the abuses in the first book. Uncle Tom's Cabin became one of the most powerful propaganda pieces ever written. In 1862, Stowe was introduced to Abraham Lincoln. "So," Lincoln reportedly said to her, "you're the little woman that wrote the book that made this great war." One of the effects of Douglas's bill was to kill the Whig Party, whose leaders were wishy-washy on the subject. In its place came the Republican Party, which was strongly against the spread of slavery. In 1856, the Republicans ran John C. Fremont, a famous explorer and soldier, against the Democrats' James Buchanan, a former Pennsylvania congressman and Secretary of State, who had Southern sympathies. Buchanan, a heavy man with tiny feet and almost no backbone, won. He proved to be a worthless president. Keynes and Congressmen. This is how emotional the issue of slavery was. In the spring of 1856, Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner, an acid-tongued abolitionist, launched a long and personal attack on South Carolina Senator Andrew P. Butler, an elderly man who had the unfortunate habit of drooling. So nasty was Sumner's attack on Butler, who was not there at the time, that Senator Stephen Douglas warned, "That damn fool will get himself killed by some other damn fool." The other damn fool turned out to be Butler's nephew, a congressman named Preston Brooks. 2 days after Sumner's speech, Brooks approached him as he sat at his desk on the Senate floor and began beating Sumner with a cane until he fell bloody and unconscious to the floor. "I gave him about 30 first-rate stripes," Brooks later bragged. Sumner was so badly shaken he could not return to Congress for 3 years. Brooks resigned his House seat and then was reelected. The North got a martyr out of the deal. The South, a hero. Making a dreadful decision. Dred Scott was a slave who was temporarily taken by his master to Illinois, which was a free state. When they returned to Missouri, Scott sued for his freedom, claiming that his time in Illinois, on free soil, made him an ex-slave. Remember, but the 7 Southern members of the U.S. Supreme Court, led by Chief Justice Roger Taney, found against Scott in 1857. The court decided that as an African American, Scott wasn't a U.S. citizen, and thus had no right to sue, that as a Missouri resident, Illinois laws didn't apply to him, and that as a slave, he was property, just like a mule, and the government had no right to deprive his master of property without a good reason. The decision absolutely infuriated people in the North. The court's contention that Scott had no more rights than a mule caused many moderate Northerners to take a harder look at the true injustice of slavery. The decision, along with the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850, also added greatly to business on the Underground Railroad, the name given to a network of abolitionists in the North and South who worked together to get escaped slaves to freedom, often in Canada. It's estimated that the system, which involved conductors and stations or hiding places, helped from 50,000 to 100,000 people with their escape. Squaring off for a showdown, the Lincoln-Douglas debate. In 1858, Lincoln challenged Douglas to a series of 7 debates as part of their race for a U.S. Senate seat in Illinois. It was a classic confrontation. Douglas, the incumbent, was barely 5 feet tall, with a big head made larger by his pompadour hairstyle. He was resplendent in finely tailored suits and arrived for the debates in a private railroad car. Lincoln was 6 feet 4 inches, with a homely face topped by a shock of unruly hair. He wore ill-fitting suits that stopped well short of his wrists and ankles and arrived for the debates on whatever passenger train was available. Their debate strategies were simple. Douglas tried to make Lincoln look like an abolitionist, which he wasn't, and Lincoln tried to make Douglas look like he was pro-slavery, which he wasn't. But they did have a fundamental disagreement on what the eventual outcome of slavery would be. Douglas won the election, but Lincoln won a national reputation. In the meantime, the country edged closer to a final showdown, needing only a spark to set off the firestorm. It got two. Spark number one, John Brown. John Brown was an Ohio abolitionist who was crazier than an outhouse rat. He believed he had been commanded by God to free the slaves, and he went about it by killing people in the Kansas fighting. On October 16, 1859, Brown led a group of 18 white and black men on a raid on the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, Virginia. After killing the mayor and taking some hostages, Brown's gang was surrounded by militia and U.S. troops under the command of Captain Robert E. Lee. Brown and five others were captured and the rest killed. After a trial, Brown was hanged. Many Southerners were convinced Brown had done what a lot of Northerners wanted to do. Many Northerners considered him a martyr to a noble cause. Spark number two, Lincoln's election. Lincoln, now a national figure, was nominated by the Young Republican Party as its 1860 presidential candidate, mostly because they thought he would appeal to the North and the West. But the Democrats were split by the slavery issue. Douglas was the official nominee, but a splinter group supported Buchanan's vice president, John Breckinridge of Tennessee. And a fourth group of moderates, called the Union Party, supported John Bell of Kentucky. When the votes were in, Lincoln had won less than a majority of the popular vote, but easily won the electoral vote and was the new president. Before he could take office, however, seven southern states had already pulled out of the Union. Buchanan did nothing to try to stop them, and once the fighting started, they were followed by four more. As the sun rose on April 12, 1861, secessionist guns fired on Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor, South Carolina. America's Civil War had begun. Chapter 10. A Most Uncivil War, 1861 to 1865. In this chapter, welcoming Lincoln to the White House, assessing the respective strengths and strategies of the North and the South, ending slavery, or at least starting the process, surveying the Civil War's key events, and analyzing the North's victory. It pitted brother against brother and killed more American soldiers than any other war in U.S. history. But from this terrible struggle emerged a country that had fought its toughest enemy, itself, and won. This chapter is a guide to key aspects of the Civil War, from the man who strove to reunite the nation to the beginning of the end of slavery, to who won which battle where. For a closer look at the Civil War, check out The Civil War for Dummies, written by Keith D. Dixon and published by Wiley. Introducing Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln began his presidency by sneaking into Washington, D.C. Because of a suspected assassination plot in Baltimore, Lincoln's railroad car was rerouted to arrive at a different time than was publicly announced. It was an inauspicious beginning to a very tough job. Within a few months of Lincoln taking office, 11 states, Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, and Virginia left the Union, and 4 more, Delaware, Kentucky, Maryland, and Missouri, were thinking about leaving. The man in charge of sorting out the whole mess had received only about 40% of the popular vote, although he's now considered one of the most extraordinary men in America and world history. Lincoln was more of a puzzle than a leader to most Americans at the time. Presenting the 16th President. Lincoln was an enormously complex person. He had a great sense of humor, but also an air of deep sorrow and melancholy about him, exacerbated by the death of his beloved mother when he was only 9, the deaths of 2 of his 4 sons before him, and his wife suffering from mental illness. He was ambitious and purposeful, but he was also modest and cheerfully ready to poke fun at himself. Lincoln didn't drink, was skeptical when it came to organized religion, although he professed a belief in God, and delighted in telling racy stories. He was also at ease with his ungainly appearance, 6 feet 4 inches tall and weighing 180 pounds, with large hands and feet, and usually just smiled when his enemies referred to him as an ape. He often dressed in all black and wore a stovepipe hat in which he sometimes stored his correspondence. Lincoln spoke with a high squeak, which may have been why he kept his speeches short. One popular and perhaps apocryphal story about Lincoln is that when a young girl suggested he grow a beard to improve his appearance, he whimsically did so between the election and his inauguration. Remember, Lincoln's greatest gift may have been his ability to use people, in the best sense of the term. He could overlook people's faults, and even their dislike of him, if he thought they had something to offer, and he did so with humor and grace. Case in point, when a troublemaker reported to him that his Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, had called the president a damned fool, Lincoln replied, "Then I must be one, for Stanton is generally right, and he always says what he means." He had plenty of need and opportunity to use his gift of getting the most out of people. Throughout his presidency, Lincoln had few close friends or advisors. His cabinet, notably William Seward, Secretary of State, Salmon P. Chase, Secretary of the Treasury, and Stanton, Secretary of War, represented a wide range of political philosophies. The biggest thing the men had in common was their low opinion of their boss, at least at the start of the war. Fortunately, Lincoln had a talent for making his point without being confrontational. Exasperated at the reluctance of General George B. McClellan to fight, for example, Lincoln drolly observed that if General McClellan does not want to use the army, I would like to borrow it. Ultimately, Lincoln was able to use his many gifts and unique personality to rally people in the North to keep fighting, first for the cause of preserving the Union, and later for the cause of ending slavery. Jefferson Davis. As President of the Confederate States of America, Jefferson Davis may have been Lincoln's counterpart, but he was in no way his equal. Davis was stiff, unyielding, narrow-minded, and humorless. Born in 1808, Davis was a West Point graduate who was wounded and decorated for bravery in the Mexican War. He was also a U.S. Senator and served as Secretary of War under President Franklin Pierce. With his brother, Davis owned a Mississippi plantation and believed in good treatment of slaves. But he also firmly believed in the institution of slavery. After Lincoln's election, Davis resigned his Senate seat. Although he first opposed secession, he accepted the presidency of the Confederate States as a compromise candidate. His presidency was plagued by mediocre cabinet members, quarreling among the rebel states, and his own inability to think other people could possibly be right if they didn't agree with him. When the South's major armies surrendered, Davis fled with what was left of the government's treasury and vowed to fight on. He was soon captured, however, and thrown in a prison cell for almost 2 years without a trial. Upon his release, he went to Canada before returning to Mississippi. Davis spent his remaining years writing about how the war's outcome was everyone else's fault. He died in 1889. More than 250,000 people attended his funeral, many of them nostalgic for the Old South he represented. Understanding Lincoln's views on slavery and the Union. Born in Kentucky in 1809, Lincoln lost his mother when he was 9 and moved with his father, a farmer, to Indiana and then to Illinois. Lincoln had almost no formal schooling. After leaving home, he took a flatboat trip down the Mississippi, worked in a store, became a lawyer, and at 25 was elected to the state legislature. In 1846, he was elected to Congress, but by 1850, he had given up on politics. As the slavery debate grew hotter, however, Lincoln decided to re-enter the political arena in 1854 and fight against its spread. Remember, that Lincoln opposed slavery is clear. "If slavery is not wrong, then nothing is wrong," he once wrote. "I cannot remember when I did not so think and feel." But like most white Americans, he thought black Americans were inferior, and he wasn't in favor of immediate freedom for slaves. He also didn't think blacks and whites could live together. "My first impulse would be to free all the slaves and send them to Liberia, to their own native land," he once said. "But a moment's reflection would convince me that whatever high hope, as I think there is, there may be in this, in the long run, its sudden execution would be impossible." As President of the United States, Lincoln put a higher value on preserving the Union than on ending slavery. "If I could save the Union without freeing any slaves," he wrote, "I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that." He was also adamant that no states would be allowed to leave the Union without a fight. "A husband and wife may be divorced," he said, "but the different parts of our country cannot. Intercourse, either amicable or hostile, must continue between them." Bending the Constitution to preserve the Union and win re-election. Not everyone in the North felt the same way. As the war progressed, opposition to it formed around peace Democrats, who called for negotiating a way to let the wayward sisters go in peace. The more radical of these peace Democrats, who actually called for disloyalty to the federal government, were dubbed copperheads after the poisonous snake that strikes without warning. The generally patient Lincoln had no patience with the copperheads. In some areas, he suspended their rights to have a speedy trial and be charged with a specific crime when arrested. More than 13,000 people were arrested and held without trial during the Civil War. By taking these actions, Lincoln disregarded the Constitution in his drive to preserve the Union. In fact, several of Lincoln's actions were declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, but only after the war ended. In 1864, Lincoln was up for re-election. He feared he might lose to someone not as devoted to preserving the Union. So again he bent some rules, suspending voting rights in some anti-Union areas of the border states and arranging for Union soldiers to leave so they could go home and vote, presumably for him. In addition, the Republican Party formed a temporary alliance with Democrats who favored the war, thereby creating the Union Party. The Democrats against the war put up George McClellan, a general whom Lincoln had twice removed from command. Despite his fears about not being reelected, Lincoln won 55% of the popular vote and held a comfortable 212-21 margin in the Electoral College. Fortunately for the country, the war remained Lincoln's responsibility to the end. with malice to none, with charity to all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, he said in his second inaugural address. Thanks for coming, Abe. One of the most famous speeches in American history is Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. But the speech wasn't exactly a big hit when he delivered it on November 19, 1863. The occasion was the dedication of the National Cemetery at the site of the Battle of Gettysburg in Pennsylvania. The cemetery had been ordered because many of the 8,000 bodies that fell there had been so hastily buried after the battle that they'd become exposed again. Lincoln wasn't even the featured speaker. That honor fell to Edward Everett, a famous orator who'd been a U.S. senator and president of Harvard University. Everett spoke for nearly 2 hours and delivered some 1,500 long and windy sentences before he finally sat down. Lincoln, who, contrary to myth, didn't write his 268-word speech on the back of an envelope during the train trip to Gettysburg, spoke for about 3 minutes. He was interrupted several times by applause. When he was done, a Philadelphia newspaper reporter on the stage leaned over and whispered to Lincoln, "Is that all?" Lincoln replied, "Yes, for the present." North versus South, comparing advantages and action plans. If London bookies had been taking bets on the outcome of the American Civil War, they may have set the odds a little in favor of the South based on the Confederacy's advantages. Sure, the North had some big pluses, including the following. A population of about 22 million compared to about 9 million in the South, of which 3.5 million were slaves. In addition, immigration during the war added thousands of new recruits for the Union Army. 7 times as much manufacturing, which meant the Union Army was always better supplied. A far better railroad system, 75% of all the track in America, which greatly aided the transport of troops and supplies. Control of the U.S. Navy and the merchant fleet. A central government already in place, and a more diverse economy, and Lincoln. Remember, the South, however, had a number of its own advantages. The benefit of history. The Southern secessionists were in good company. Secession by determined regions had previously succeeded in Latin America, the Netherlands, Greece, and the 13 American colonies, just to name a few places. A defensive stance. The Confederacy didn't have to conquer the North or even win a lot of big battles. It only had to fight long enough for the North to give up its quest to bring the Southern states back into the Union. A defensive war is much cheaper to fight than an offensive one in terms of both men and materials. Although the South's population was smaller overall, it still had about 200,000 men available to fight within a short time of the war's start. Home field advantage. Much of the fighting was on the South's territory because the North had to conquer the South to get it back into the Union. Southerners not only knew the terrain, but also had the incentive of defending their homes and farms. Of course, as the war progressed, they found that fighting on the home field wasn't all it was cracked up to be. Strong military leadership. The South had more able military leaders right from the start, particularly a courtly and brilliant Virginian named Robert E. Lee and his right-hand man, a former military school instructor who liked to suck on lemons, named Thomas Stonewall Jackson. To win, reasoned General Winfield Scott, the top Northern general, who was 75 and so fat he couldn't get on a horse, the first step was to suffocate the South by blockading its coast. Next, cut it in half by seizing the Mississippi River. Then, chop it up by cutting across Georgia and then up through the Carolinas. Finally, capture the Confederate capital of Richmond, Virginia. Many northern newspapers sneered at Scott's strategy as too timid. They suggested abandoning his Anaconda Plan, so-called because it envisioned encircling the South and squeezing the life out of it like a giant snake, in favor of marching directly on Richmond and getting the whole thing over with. But Lincoln recognized the worth of Scott's approach. Confederate President Jefferson Davis, meanwhile, favored a simpler plan for the South. Make the Northern armies press the fight, whip them, and push them back north, thereby breaking the morale of the Northern people. General Lee concurred at first, but then realized that the South's limited resources might be better used in a quick and decisive strike to take the heart out of the North. Twice he tried to take the fight to the Union. Twice his limited resources forced him to go home. Hell no, we won't go. Although most men who fought in the Civil War were volunteers, both sides resorted to drafting troops as well. The Confederacy was first, in 1862. A year later, the North followed, but not without serious opposition. One sore point was the fact that draftees who put up $300 or hired someone to go in their place could get out of serving. Men who took advantage of the exemption included tycoons, or soon-to-be tycoons, such as J.P. Morgan and Andrew Carnegie, and future President Grover Cleveland. Another issue was the dislike of many Irish immigrants for African Americans, whom they feared would compete with them for jobs. The worst anti-draft troubles occurred in New York City. In July 1863, mostly Irish anti-draft mobs, chanting, "To hell with the draft and the war," terrorized the city for 4 days. More than 400 people were killed, and $5 million worth of damage was done. The riots weren't stopped until federal troops arrived. The draft was subsequently suspended in the city for the rest of the war. Freeing the slaves. One of Lincoln's most pressing problems was what to do about slaves. As soon as Northern troops moved into Southern territory, escaped slaves poured into Union Army camps. One general declared them seized property and put them to work in labor battalions so they could earn their keep. But other generals who favored abolition immediately declared them free. Lincoln was forced to rescind the latter orders because, as president, he felt that freeing slaves was solely his responsibility and because he had to be careful not to antagonize the slaveholding states that had stayed loyal to the Union, Delaware, Kentucky, Maryland, and Missouri, and later West Virginia, which broke away from Virginia during the war. Lincoln hoped each state would abolish slavery on its own and compensate slave owners so federal funds could be used to send freed slaves to Africa. When that didn't happen, Lincoln chose a different course. Proclaiming Emancipation. In June 1862, members of Congress who were impatient with Lincoln's caution mustered enough votes to abolish slavery in the District of Columbia and the U.S. territories. Congress also authorized Lincoln to allow the Union Army to enlist African Americans who wanted to fight. Prodded by these congressional actions, Lincoln then told his cabinet in July that he intended to proclaim freedom for slaves as of January 1, 1863. But he wanted to wait until the Union Army had won a big battle before making the announcement. On September 22, 5 days after the Union gained what was more of a tie than a win at Antietam Creek, Maryland, Lincoln made his Emancipation Proclamation public. As of January 1st, he announced, "All slaves in any state still in rebellion shall be then, thenceforth and forever, free." Surveying the consequences of emancipation. Remember, in reality, Lincoln's proclamation didn't free a single slave. It didn't apply to slaves in the border states, where Union forces could have enforced it, and slave owners in the Confederacy certainly didn't obey it. But it did have effects Lincoln hadn't intended. In the South, the Emancipation Proclamation reinforced the will to fight on because it was clear that if the South lost, slavery would end. In the North, it angered some who were comfortable fighting to preserve the Union, but not the free people who might then come North and compete with them for jobs. Abolitionists thought the Emancipation Proclamation didn't go far enough, while other people thought the government had no right to take away the Southern slave owners' property. But many Northerners gradually came to embrace the idea of abolishing slavery as a moral cause, and Lincoln's move added another reason for the North to continue to fight. Just as important, working people in England and France cheered the emancipation of slaves. At one point, a letter of support was sent to Lincoln that supposedly came from 20,000 laborers in England. Such support helped ensure that European leaders wouldn't risk the wrath of public opinion by aiding the South. Reviewing the troops, the generals, and the major battles. The Civil War was mostly a young man's fight. Most of the enlisted men were under the age of 21, and more than a few were in their early teens. The Civil War was also truly a brother's war, with families and friends divided by their allegiances. Mary Lincoln, the president's wife, lost three brothers in the war. They had all fought for the South. The Confederacy's leading general, Robert E. Lee, had a nephew who was also an officer in the Union Navy. Because of the fraternal flavor of the two armies, it wasn't unusual for them to engage in friendly banter between battles, sometimes even getting together for a game of baseball or to trade tobacco for coffee during truces. Remember, the friendliness didn't stop the carnage. More than 600,000 American soldiers died during the Civil War. That's more than the number who died in World War I, World War II, and the Korean War combined. About two-thirds of that number died from diseases rather than battle wounds, and it's estimated the average soldier ended up in the hospital at least once or twice a year. If the soldier ever left the hospital, he was lucky. Sanitary conditions were awful, and 75% of the operations consisted of amputations, many of them needless. Northern forces almost always outnumbered their Southern opponents. At the end of the war, the Union Army had about 960,000 men in uniform compared to the Confederates' 445,000. In addition to having a larger population to draw from, the North's forces also included thousands of European immigrants who took up a rifle almost as soon as they got off the boat. Additionally, thousands of African Americans fought for the North after being allowed to join the Army in 1863. They were paid $7 a month, about a third of what white soldiers got, and they fought well under white officers, earning the grudging respect of those they fought against and alongside. A scene from hell. 1,100 dead bodies, swollen to twice the natural size, lying in every conceivable position, some on their backs with gaping jaws, some with eyes as large as walnuts, protruding with a glassy stare, some doubled up like a contortionist, here one without a head, there one without legs, yonder a head and legs without a trunk. Everywhere, horrible expressions. From an eyewitness account after the Battle of Chancellorsville, May 1863. The men at the top. What each side did have, at least by the close of the war, was a great general at the head of its army. In the South, that man was Robert E. Lee, the son of a Revolutionary War general. A West Point graduate, Lee was asked by Lincoln to lead the Union Army before the war began. But Lee's loyalties were to his native state of Virginia. He was honorable, courteous, skillful, and not afraid to take a chance. Lee's northern counterpart was Ulysses S. Grant, the shy and disheveled son of a storekeeper. Grant was also a West Point grad, but he resigned his commission to avoid a court-martial for drunkenness. He rejoined the army and rose through the ranks to command mainly because, unlike some of his contemporaries, he wasn't afraid to get into a fight. Grant was highly intelligent, determined, compassionate, and a cold-eyed killer, if that's what it took to win. The War at Sea. The North's first objective was to blockade the southern coast and cut off the South's ability to trade its cotton in Europe for arms and supplies. The Union Navy already had ships and guns, but the South somehow managed to scrounge up a navy of its own from refitted private ships or ships built for the South in England, as well as scores of captured Union merchant ships. Remember, one of the Confederacy's ships was a Union vessel called the Merrimack, which had been sunk. Southern shipfitters raised it, covered it with iron plates, and renamed it the Virginia. For a few days, it terrorized